The following is an encore presentation of one of many Financial Sense premium programs, which are available every week to premium subscribers only. For more information on premium subscriptions, go to our financialsense.com website and click on the subscribe link provided.
The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
One of the biggest Ponzi schemes in financial history was exposed right in the middle of a financial crisis in 2008. Bernie Madoff, one of the most prestigious firms on Wall Street, twice president of the NASD, and yet a fund manager to royalty and a who's who, not only in this country, but around the globe. It took a financial crisis to bring and expose Madoff's Ponzi scheme. But before the Ponzi scheme and before the exposure, there was one individual that knew was a fraud right from the beginning. In fact, he investigated it and laid a case to the SEC, laid a case to the media, laid a case to the financial industry the whole time it was ignored. Joining me on the program today was the whistleblower in the Bernie Madoff case, Harry Markopoulos, who's also author of a book, No One Would Listen, A True Financial Thriller. Harry joins me now.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Harry, you know, one of the things that struck me about reading your book, in 1991, you and I guess it was your chief investment officer, Frank Casey, and a couple others at your firm were looking at the Madoff returns. And the one thing that stood out when you looked at, I guess it was a marketing brochure that you were looking at, is the steady rate of returns and options. And, you know, I know options. And if anything, you know, you're either making a fortune or you're losing a fortune, but not possible to see this steady growth. Is that what really stood out when you looked at the brochure and said, there's something wrong here?
Yes. Bernie's returns were going up at a 45-degree angle on a straight line. And we don't have straight lines in finance. And in options, everything is a curve. There is nothing straight in an option. And so I knew it had to be fraudulent right off the bat in the first 5 minutes.
And you guys at that time, I guess, were trying to develop a product that could be sold to feeder funds. And I guess maybe it was at Frank that either a colleague or boss, he had just got back from New York with the marketing brochure. And he said, you know, how can we duplicate this? And you basically had to tell him, you can't.
I did. Frank was my counterpart in marketing. So we were at the same rank. And I sent him down to New York to take a look at this Madoff product that I've been hearing about. And he did. And he brought back a one-page tear sheet. And in 5 minutes, I knew it was a fraud because Bernie's batting average, if you had to put it in baseball terms, he would have been batting a 966 and no one in Major League Baseball thinking that was suspicious.
Now, here's the thing that really struck me, because one of the largest feeder funds was the Ascot Fund. And it was like a who's who. They had wealthy. They had royalty. They even had some other Wall Street firms. Did nobody ever question that?
No. Here was a case where the emperor is wearing no clothes, and everybody's afraid to admit that. Everybody's looking to the left and to the right and are seeing smart, supposedly sophisticated investors thinking, wow, those people to my left and right are certainly smarter than I am. Those are big firms. Those are important people. Certainly they must have checked. So why should I check? I'm just a nobody. I don't have to do any due diligence. It must be safe because all these other smart folks are in there too.
And wasn't one of the marketing geniuses that he used was that, you know, it was like he was doing you a favor if he let you in. He always played that, well, you know what, we're kind of full right now. We're not taking on much money. But for you, Mr. Jones, I will do it as a favor. It was sort of like everybody wanting to get in, but it was like an exclusive club.
He treated it like it was the dating circuit in high school. Who did you like the most in high school? Probably the person that turned you down
for a date to go to the prom. You like
them the most. And so Bernie would turn down people. And then if he saw you a second time, he was predisposed to saying, yes, you're special, and to making up a reason why he was going to let you in this time. And you only had one shot in. I'm only going to let you in this one time. And he did that for a purpose. He didn't want some of your money. He wanted all of your money. He wanted you to go out and redeem all your other assets from your diversified portfolio and give him 100 cents of every dollar that you owned.
So you're thinking, well, boy, he turned me down the first time. The second time, he's given me a special favor. Boy, I need to get as much as I can with this guy because I'm getting in on a deal with all these famous people.
And you only get one chance to join that money club, so you have to go all in. And that's the way Ponzi schemers do it. They don't want some of your money. They need all of it. And not only that, they want your friends' money and the rest of your family's money, too, because word of mouth is their best marketing ploy. And they need that because Ponzi schemes are cash-devouring monsters. Once the money stops rolling in, the scheme stops, and everybody who's involved in the scheme goes to jail, unfortunately, and the investors are left out of luck.
Now, when you started looking into this, you were really convinced, boy, this is a big fraud. You went to the SEC, and you laid out all the red flags with the Boston SEC. I think it was in May of 2000, as I recall. Why did they turn you away? I mean, was it because you were calling one of the most successful men on Wall Street a fraud?
No, it was the director of enforcement in Boston at that time was a lawyer, a securities lawyer, who really didn't know the financial markets and didn't understand a thing that I said because he was not trained in finance. And that's the way the agency was back then in 2000. And he said he was going to forward my red flags document to the SEC in New York so they could do something about it. And he did. He put it in the trash immediately. He didn't understand a word I said.
Wow. Now, at some point, you felt there was a risk to your life. There had been another whistleblower in a mutual fund case who was found in a parking lot beat to a pulp. When did you first become aware that your life was in danger to the point where you went out and got a license to carry a gun and you start going to gun ranges and target practicing?
Well, I'd spent 17 years in the Army as a National Guard and Reserve officer, so I knew how to handle a gun, and I grew up in Pennsylvania hunting. So I didn't need a whole lot of target practice, but it didn't get dangerous for the first 2.5 years. When I go to Europe in June of 2002, and I meet with 20 different hedge fund feeder funds, 14 of which have Bernie, and at that point, I know this case is suddenly very, very dangerous because I saw the offshore nature of those feeder funds. And I realized the clients that Bernie was stealing money from, the best thing you could say about those clients is they were all tax cheats in their home countries. And then it went quickly to there, to Russians and Colombians and organized crime. And I realized that if Bernie is stealing from organized crime and they catch him, well, they have a unique and very special way of terminating investment managers, don't they? So he had a lot of risk on the table. And if he's going to get killed and he has a choice to make, kill me or see himself be killed, I think I knew how he was going to come down on making his decision, and so I got very, very frightened, and at that point I started carrying a gun and checking for bombs.
You know, something else happened. There was a period of time where the SEC went and they investigated Madoff, and they found nothing, so in a way, they gave him the green light, and once that, Bernie could say, hey, look, they've looked at me. They didn't find anything. What was it that they were overlooking? In other words, how could they look at this guy with the material that you laid out for him and walk away and give him the good housekeeping stamp of approval?
They were checking the wrong things. Their expertise in New York was checking for front-running violations. Bernie had one of the larger brokerage firm operations on the street. He's trading 5 to 10% of the daily stock exchange volume in the United States. And so the SEC is wrongly assuming that his returns are real, but that he's cheating to get them. And I'm coming in saying, you don't understand, he's not trading. There are no trades. He's not real. The returns are not real. It's a Ponzi scheme. I'm telling them it's a Ponzi scheme. And they said, no, he can't be doing that. That's too simple. He wouldn't have gotten away with that. And so they were checking for the more complex thing, and they could never prove that he was doing it because he was never trading. And the easy thing, the Ponzi scheme, they never checked out. It would have taken a half hour of their time to prove my allegations, and they never bothered to check.
Now, at some point, you and some of your colleagues began to form the equivalent of an intelligence network. I mean, you guys really started to delve into this. And what really struck me is if Madoff was supposedly as big as he was, and he was doing all of his business in options, when you talk to people on the street that were involved in the option business, number one, nobody did business with Bernie, so that would confirm your suspicion that these trades were never being made. And number two, wouldn't it strike you if you're involved in options and he's supposed to be this big that you would never have any contact or be doing trades with this individual?
Oh, to me, I knew right away it was a fraud. My firm was trading billions of dollars of derivatives every month, and I would simply call the large firms on the street that I know Bernie would have had to have been dealing with and ask, are you trading for Bernie? And they all told me, no, we think he's a fraud. So then I called down to the Chicago Board Options Exchange. And those people down there said, he's supposed to be the largest trader of options in the world. We don't see any of his orders. He's a fraud. And so I put down on my witness list the names of these individuals that I had these conversations with. And the SEC never bothered to pick up the phone. Neither did the press. All the press had to do was call my witnesses. No one bothered to investigate. They thought Bernie was above reproach.
So going back to once the SEC gave the green light on Bernie, more and more money began to roll in. Is it an issue, Harry, that they were either one, asleep at the wheel, two, they were outgunned, or three, maybe just inept, or maybe four, a combination of all of the above?
Well, back then, the SEC was severely under-resourced. It was a stepping stone to getting a better job, and it was a turnstile. So people would go in there, pad their resume, and leave. And they had the wrong type of people. They were, at that time, over-lawyered. They couldn't afford to have real finance people work there. And now it's totally different. But back then, I'm telling you, the place was very dysfunctional, just like all of our financial regulators. Look at the bank examiners. They did a much worse job than the SEC did. So they all failed the nation. And what happened? The financial crisis of 2008 happened. That's something that not only we'll be paying for generations to come, but probably our children and maybe our grandchildren. And so that was the way government was back then. No one checked anything. And in fact, no one would do a big case against a large firm because those cases were very politically sensitive. And the regulators were all captive to the industries that they pretended to be regulating. So basically, we had regulators that were working for the bad guys. They really weren't working for us citizens, us taxpayers, the people that paid their salaries. And that was a problem. It's still a problem in certain areas of the government. I'd say the SEC is better these days. But other agencies, like the bank examiners, are not any better than they were in 2008.
Now, when you put all this evidence that you gathered through your intelligence network, like talking to the option players and, you know, everybody said, if he's supposed to be the biggest guy, we've never done a trade with him. So you had it all laid out. Did you have any luck? I mean, did you ever get to somebody that said that, look, here's step A, B, C, D, E. Just follow this lead. It's going to lead you right to the problem or the fraud. Did they ever look at that? Because you basically gave it to him on a silver platter.
In Boston at the SEC office, there were several people that did believe me.
I'd say that Ed Mannion in that office.
And I worked very closely on that case for almost a decade. Mike Garrity.
Then a branch chief, now the assistant regional director
of the office leading up the exam teams. He believed me. And he told me, if this was in Boston, under our jurisdiction, I would have multiple teams in there tomorrow tearing this place apart. Unfortunately, it's in New York, in their jurisdiction, so I have to send this great case down there. And they did, and New York did nothing with it except ignore it. And when they finally did put a team on it in late 2005, they put the wrong people on it, very junior people that were inexperienced, did not know how to conduct an investigation. They were untrained, as was most of the SEC staff at that point in time, and so of course they missed it.
You know, something that also happened, and this was brought up in the congressional hearings after the Madoff scandal broke, and they were talking to, I guess, maybe one of the heads of that investigation, and she had to recuse herself because, I guess, her associate married into the Madoff family. So SEC employees got involved. I can't think of the name of the investigator, but married either Bernie's niece.
Eric Swanson, he was an SEC enforcement attorney in Washington. It sounded suspicious, but actually he was not corrupt. Certainly he would have known my name, and if he had told Uncle Bernie, I'd be dead. And I'm still here, so I'm convinced he was very honest. In fact, I testified to that before the Securities and Exchange Commission Inspector General. I didn't think he had anything to do with the case, and I think he was honest. And I don't think the rest of the family was, perhaps, but he certainly was. He did his job, but there were a lot of things suspicious in that case. It was truly the Twilight Zone. You couldn't make this up if you were a bad fiction writer. But that's how real life is, isn't it?
Wow. You had this gentleman, Villachey, who was with one of the largest feeder funds. And as you guys were presenting him the information, saying, hey, have you looked at this? This doesn't look right here. I think he said something like, I guess you guys said, what if you're wrong? And he said, if I'm wrong, I'm a dead man.
And truer words were never spoken. He was warned repeatedly by myself and by Frank Casey. And Frank confronted him and said, you know, what if you're wrong? And he did say those exact words. If you are right and I am wrong, then I am a dead man. And 11 days after Madoff turned himself in, Terry de Villachey committed suicide in a very gruesome fashion. The day before, he had sent out one of his interns to buy him the sharpest letter opener he could find. And so he went to a Staples
on Madison Avenue, in the vicinity of Madison Avenue,
bought that letter opener. And later the next day, after everybody had left, he locked his office door, took some painkillers, and he slashed his wrist and his arms, and he cut in very deeply, and he bled out into a trash can. And he did that not to leave a mess for the cleaning crew, because he was always a gentleman. When he did that, to atone for his sins, he had let down his family and the families of many of European royalty, and he knew that his reputation was gone. He had lost over $50 million of his own money. He was basically penniless. And he had lost between $1.4 and $1.6 billion of his clients' money. And those family relationships went back among the royal families for centuries. And so for him, it was an act of atonement, and it was the only way he felt that he could apologize. And he did it, I think, in the wrong way. And it's very disturbing to me to this day that he did what he did, but that's how royals go out.
Mm. Now, going back, when you were developing this intelligence, you went to the SEC, and you also went to the media, which was surprising. No one was interested, and you got really discouraged, and you thought, you know, it's time to leave the industry. How do people fight back? Because we hear about some of these scandals today. One that I see happen all the time. In fact, I'm on to a scandal right now with naked short selling. I've talked to the media. I've talked to the authorities. Nobody seems to care. So what are individual investors supposed to be thinking out there when guys like you uncover something, you go to the authorities, which you're following the chain of command in your profession, and then go to the media and they look the other way?
Problem with this case and with law large cases is they can be too big to be believed. People assume it can't be that large. Certainly someone would have seen the elephant in the room. And so they assume that the elephant's not there, but it really is. And so you come in, and I'm telling them that Bernie is 12 to 20 billion the second time I submit in March 2001. Well, that's 6 to 10 times larger than the large hedge funds that the SEC knows about. And Bernie is very silent. No one knows he's really running a hedge fund. And they don't think a hedge fund can be that large, 12 to 20 billion. So the case was too big to be believed. And I think you get into certain cases like the mortgage fraud that we saw just a few years ago. That was trillions of dollars. No one could believe that you could have a fraud for trillions of dollars, but certainly it existed. As for naked short selling, obviously another too big to be believed fraud, but they're real. Those frauds are real. And the press is just assuming that they can't be. They're just too big. And so they're not going to report on it. So this case, I submitted it to Forbes magazine. I submitted it to the Wall Street Journal repeatedly. One of my teammates, Michael Okrant, sent it to the New York Times. They didn't believe it, or if they did, they would come back and say, you know, this has already been reported on twice in 2001, once by my team, by Michael Okrant, and once by Aaron Arvelin at Barron's. There's nothing new here. Well, of course, this case was a Pulitzer Prize. All you had to do was report on it and break this scheme wide open if you're a journal reporter or you're working for the New York Times or Forbes. But they all assumed that it couldn't be real. It was too big. And Bernie was beyond reproach. He had a great resume, as all good fraudsters do. And so they didn't believe me. And that's a problem that you're going to have with the press, especially these days, because how is the press doing as an industry? It's barely making any money. And so the quality of journalism is only going to go downhill from now into the future. And as a result, maybe we're not going to have professional journalists 10 years from now. Maybe it's all bloggers.
Maybe it's all on Twitter. And maybe it's all online. Maybe there are no more newspapers or magazines. So how is journalism going to pay for itself? Is this a profession without an industry going forward? It may be.
Yeah, because I'm not going to mention the organization, I spent an hour and a half laying out all the evidence, painting a picture, crossing the, you know, linking all the dots together. And the one thing is, no, this can't be. This is just almost the same response that you got. Questions, did you go to the authorities? Yes, I've gone to the authorities. They haven't done anything. I mean, I got an hour and a half's time explaining the story and laying out all my sources like you did. But it was like, no, this just doesn't sound like this could be possible. But nonetheless, it is. I want to talk about something Bernie did as well. In addition to sort of like being very selective in terms of who he took on as client, he also shared a lot of the loot of the fees with the feeder fund. So everybody, you know, he wasn't greedy. He was sharing the pie generously with the feeder funds. Was that also responsible for the degree of success that he had in perpetuating this thing?
Yes, Bernie was a creature of Wall Street, and there we have a saying, little pigs get fat, big pigs get slaughtered, and he knew that. And the brilliance of his scheme and taking it global like he did was he would share the wealth. Over 90%, I'm convinced, over 90% of the fees went to the feeder funds for selling a product that was able to sell itself. The returns were that good. They were literally too good to be true. And so he's making all these feeder fund people rich. And that's all they care about. And they don't look past the fact that here's the golden goose. He's laying a stream of golden eggs for me. His check's clear. He's making me rich. I don't want to stop that. I want to participate as Bernie's partner. And so they didn't do their due diligence. They never asked questions about the red flags that appeared in front of them. It was enough that they were getting paid and paid very well.
Now, there was a guy at the SEC. Correct me if I have his name. Was it Mike Garrity at the SEC that was basically saying, look, there really is a wolf out there?
It was Ed Mannion and Mike Garrity pressed this case forward along with their boss, Walter Ricciardi. And so the Boston office believed me. Unfortunately, the New York office did not. And the relationship between the New York regional office and Boston was about as warm and friendly as the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry.
Ugh.
And so there was regional turf battles. There was not one centralized place where whistleblowers could go. They had 11 regional offices with 11 different ways of handling whistleblowers, and you had the headquarters in Washington with yet another way. So you had 12 different ways of handling whistleblowers, and nothing was coherent. Everything was ad hoc, one-off basis. Well, now they have an office of the whistleblower as a result of this case, staffed by 18 people. When they take a case in, they triage it. They get about 7 to 8 cases a day. The biggest and best cases they've ever received to come through that program, and they will pay whistleblowers 10 to 30% of any successful case that the government brings. So if there's a $100 million settlement, that whistleblower or set of whistleblowers will receive between $10 and $30 million. And the fines are basically coming out of the bad guys' pockets because they're going to get fined that money. And so they're going to be paying for the whistleblowers to turn in those frauds. And that sort of makes sense, doesn't it?
Now, there's a point in time where Madoff gets word that somewhere out there lurking is a whistleblower. You. Doesn't know who you are. You went to the Wall Street Journal. I think the guy's name was John Wilkie. But wasn't he killing the story? You were getting nowhere with the Journal.
I tried with the Journal repeatedly. They sat on that case for 3 years. And it wasn't until Madoff turned himself in that they wanted to write the story. And they wrote a very good story at that time. I wish we had done it 3 years sooner because we could have prevented many more billions of loss. By the time this thing ended in December 2008, it was $65 billion on paper, probably about $17 billion actually went into the scheme. The rest was just phantom profits people thought they had, but it wasn't real, of course. We could have stopped it a lot smaller a lot sooner if Forbes had taken it in 2001 and if the New York Times had taken it anywhere in between. And, of course, the press did not act. And it's a tragedy. This case was like the Twilight Zone. And it was always larger than life. One unbelievable thing after another happened in the case. There were no straight lines in the case at all other than Bernie's performance. The case was very tragic. It was like a nightmare. And here I'm stuck in it with my team trying to stop this guy. And everybody we go to is ignoring us saying, that can't be true. Bernie wouldn't do that. Do you know who he is? Do you know how big his firm is? Have you seen his resume? Do you know that he was the past 2-time chairman of NASDAQ? His brother was the vice chairman. You know what boards these guys sit on? You know how powerful they are in the industry? Of course this can't be true. You guys are just nothing but disgruntled competitors because you're not smart enough to be able to get those returns in the market like Bernie is. And so they thought we were cranks and quacks. And when in fact, we were competitors of his, but we were actually in the markets and we knew what was achievable in those markets. And Bernie was taking everybody for a ride. It was nothing but a giant scam. And we're crying, wolf, wolf, wolf. And there is a wolf there and no one's believing us. So you can imagine what we were thinking on our end. We knew we were sane and we knew the rest of the world was crazy. And sometimes that's just the way things are, isn't it?
Hmm. Now, the irony of this, it was the financial crisis, which is what brought Bernie down as people saw and got frightened. They started taking their money out because before that, there was nothing stopping him. Like I mentioned, you went to the media, they ignored you. You went to the government, they ignored you. Talked to people in the financial services, they either didn't care or knew about it or looked the other way. There's something flawed in the way this system works.
Mainly Wall Street relies on self-regulation, and we know that doesn't work. We proved that in 2008 in spades with the global financial crisis, and we know that the financial regulators have never been tough enough. And what lesson did we learn? Who went to jail as a result of what happened in 2008? And the answer, unfortunately, is no one went to jail. Our government says these banks are too big to fail, too big to jail. And so the industry gets a free get-out-of-jail card. And that's not right. And so all those big banks that failed and were rescued by us taxpayers are now bigger, much bigger than they were in 2008. And so no one's addressing the problem. So you can only conclude that our government, both major parties, are owned lock, stock, and barrel by corporate interests and special interests, and they don't answer to us. And that's wrong. And we know how it's going to end for us. If you want to look at a bigger fraud than short selling or Madoff, look at the way the nation balances its books. We don't. We're saying there's $18 trillion in debt. But we're not accounting for the unfunded liabilities off balance sheet of Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, and unfunded federal employment benefits. And so we have a full set of books in the federal government too. And so those are continuing problems, and the press really needs to report on it, but they don't.
No, they're absolutely silent. We go with the silly stories. I guess we're more interested in what's going on in Justin Bieber's life. What really struck me is, towards the end, when you found out, Madoff goes in, he turns himself in. It's front news headlines all over the financial channels, the major news stories. Your first thought was you were worried about the government. Explain that, because, you've told your wife, here's a gun, and if the door opens and I'm not in front walking through that door, you protect yourself. And you're trying to get your information faxed to a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, Greg Zuckerman. Lead us through what your thinking was at that time.
I knew that Madoff was going to prison and that he had a lot of risk on the table because he had a lot of people that were going to want to kill him now that the truth came out. He had taken the Colombian drug cartel's money. He had been stealing billions from the Russian mob. And he had stole from people, some of the most powerful people on the planet across the globe. So he turns himself in because there's no place to run or hide for him. The last thing he's worried about is fleeing to another country. No one needs the safety of a prison more than he does. He needs the gates, the guards, and the guns to survive. Me, though, I'm exposed because I have all these documents that are going to incriminate the Securities and Exchange Commission to no end. People are going to lose their reputation and their jobs. So they're the power of the government. I don't know if they want to have a search warrant executed on my house to seize my computers and my documents and make them conveniently disappear. So I need to get those documents out of my house. I need to get them publicized as quickly as I can, and I do so. Unfortunately, we're having one of the worst ice storms in modern history. Phone lines and telephone poles are going out throughout Massachusetts. The worst possible weather. I'm having trouble getting a fax line. It takes me an hour, maybe 90 minutes to get those documents faxed to the Wall Street Journal. Documents which they already had. Unfortunately, they were in the Washington Bureau office and not New York because the reporter is covering the story now is in New York. So I need to get those documents to New York. I also need to get them to my lawyers in New York, Washington, and in Boston. So it takes me all night because of the weather to get those documents distributed up and down the East Coast. I am emailing and faxing documents everywhere. Now, I don't have a fax machine, so I have to go out and borrow one. I do have email, but it's hard to get a clear connection because of the ice storm. So literally, I'm going without sleep. And of course, the next morning, my house is surrounded by the press. And so that's not a comfortable feeling or a good place to be. There's vans, cars across the street, people walking around with notebooks. I don't know if they're with the government. I don't know if they're with the press. If they have cameras, and if the truck says CBS or NBC or Channel 7 or Channel 5, I feel pretty safe. But the rest of the people, I don't know who they are out front, and I need to get those documents and talk to my lawyers. My mother-in-law is shooing everybody away from the front door saying I'm not home, but of course I'm home. I've got other more pressing matters on my mind. I have the phone disconnected. I'm using my cell phone to call out on, and I'm trying to get those documents protected, which I do, but I'm in a very nervous and precarious spot at that point. Once the documents are spread up and down the East Coast, I let out a sigh of relief. I felt a lot better at that time.
Since that time, we had, of course, the 2008 crisis. Nobody went to jail. More recently, we've had MF Global, where client funds were commingled, yet the head of the firm walks free. I've had former prosecutor Bill Black in the SNL crisis. He said, you know, the big guys can get away with just about anything because they bought and paid for the best Congress they could buy. I've had John Sotonis about high-frequency trading, about the wrongs that are going on with naked short selling today, which nobody seems to care about. As I mentioned, I've discovered a major fraud, and yet I can't get anybody to listen. I can't get the media. I haven't had luck with the government. What do investors do today?
I think we need to change our government. I think we need a 28th Constitutional Amendment where we have term limits, 6 years in office, 6 years for a congressman, 6 years for a U.S. senator, 6 years for president, no reelection, 6-year ban on lobbying after you leave office, a 6-year ban on lobbying for your staff once they stop taking a government paycheck. I think we need public financing of elections. No individual should be able to contribute to anybody's election. No corporation should either. It should be, we should return to a new form of government called democracy. It shouldn't be a corporate kleptocracy. It shouldn't be special interests and corporate interests controlling our government, owning the best Congress money can buy. If the people can't run for re-election, then they work for us full-time and they can vote their conscience without fear of retribution. And everybody has equal access because we publicly finance everybody's election. Let's say you get 2% of the signatures in your jurisdiction. Well, then we'll finance your election. Everybody gets the same pot of money to spend as he or she sees fit. Let the man or woman win. And they're only going to win once for that office because they can never run for re-election. And that's the only way we can count on those people to represent us. Because right now what's happening is, if democracy is for sale, that goes to the highest bidder. These people need campaign contributions. So every person in Congress spends at least half of his or her time raising money. If you're a U.S. senator, the last 2 years before you face re-election, 75% of your time is spent raising campaign funds. So, of course, they're for sale to the highest bidder. We need to stop that. We need to publicly finance the election cycle. We will save trillions of dollars if we do that. We will spend a few billion. It costs a total of $1.7 billion for every federal election, all combined, in 2012. I'd rather spend twice that. Let's spend $3.5 billion and publicly finance these elections and not allow corporations and special interest groups to contribute to the election cycle. Let's take it out of their hands and restore democracy to America once for all.
Final question, Harry. If you were to discover this fraud today in June 2013, and you were put in the same position, let's say Bernie Madoff was still there, you discovered Bernie, do you think that the SEC would be more willing to listen today? They're better equipped with the type of personnel they need to investigate something like this? Do you think you would have had a better chance if you were doing that today versus in the year 2000?
Oh, absolutely. It would be 180 degrees different. They have an office of the whistleblower. You can turn in tips, and they triage it.
They assign it to the staff. They get back to you, usually within 48 hours, to set up a meeting.
They want to meet you in person. They want to review the evidence in person. They want to ask you questions. They want to ask follow-up questions after you leave the office. And they send in the teams. They have industry experts working there now. They've diversified away from the all-lawyer staff that they had in the past. They actually have competent industry experts who have retired from the industry. They're not going to go back. These are people with many decades of experience that understand the cases that you bring in. They have experts for everything now. Those people didn't exist when I did the Madoff case. So it is a different agency these days. Structurally, they want to listen to whistleblowers because they know they get their biggest and best cases. From who? From insiders. People coming in who've seen the frauds, come in with the emails, come in with the transaction records, come in with the marketing
documents.
So they know everything about the fraud. It's a lot easier to solve it from the inside than trying to do it from the outside, isn't it? You can save a lot of government resources that way. So it'd be a lot different today. Unfortunately, we had to go through the global financial crisis and Madoff to get to where we are today, where you have an agency that's actually poised to do the right thing. Unfortunately, the SEC and the CFTC get it. The banking regulators continue to bury their heads in the sand. They have not improved one iota from where we were in 2008. And that's a tragedy waiting to happen again.
Well, ending on a positive note, at least they're better equipped. The name of the book was called No One Would Listen, A True Financial Thriller by Harry Markopoulos. He's been my guest on today's show. Harry, I want to thank you for the work that you did. Maybe you didn't catch Madoff and that tragedy had to unfold, but perhaps as a result of it, the SEC is better equipped today to take on these issues. And that in itself is an accomplishment I think you can be proud of.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jim. I certainly hope so. Looking forward to better things from the SEC in the future. And thank you for having me on your show today.
Well, that concludes my interview with Harry Markopoulos. I guess if I was to say something good came out of Harry's work, even though he could have saved a lot of people, a lot of fortunes, a lot of retirement money that went down the tubes when Bernie spent and through fraud, defrauded a large group of investors, many retirees who placed their life fortunes with Bernie. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. But if there's any good that came out of this today, the SEC is a much different organization. They do have a whistleblower organization that's set up that is after, and they're better equipped with the right kind of individuals. Back in 2000, it was all lawyers. And once again, as we find in all Ponzi schemes, somebody that's tied up at the very top, a very powerful individual, a who's who in society, on the boards of corporations, involved with charitable events in town, everything looks good. But sometimes that's where the biggest Ponzi schemes lie. Let's hope we learn a lesson in the future. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
You've been listening to an encore presentation of one of our Financial Sense premium programs, which are available every week to premium subscribers only. For more information on premium subscriptions, go to our financialsense.com website and click on the subscribe link provided.